afternoon. You're joining the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And?
I love staring at Bill and not saying anything.
Why do you do that?
I don't know.
Our sponsor this hour. Our sponsor this hour is Team Power. John Deere and Kubota dealer here in Shasta Lake City, California. And you want a great deal on a tractor, go by and see them. They've got all sizes and shapes on sale right now. You can also get your service and parts there. You can reach them at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, or give them a call at 226-9226, or get them on the web at readingtractors.com.
Ta-da!
There you go.
I especially like looking at Bill and waiting for him to do his commercial while he's chewing something.
That is just why do you make stuff
it's just,
up?
It's just free fun.
Oh, so unprofessional.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for the last 2 weeks, let's see, 2 weeks ago, May 27th, we did 1 hour on South Africa. And then last week, we did both hours on South Africa. And so this week, we're going to do another hour because every time we get into this topic, there's more. Obviously,
mm-hmm.
It's a huge topic that is not being covered, and I'm really, really heartened to see how many people are utilizing the archives on the website.
Yeah,
I know a lot.
Well, I'm hoping some other folks will pick it up and run with it too, because it really needs to be told.
Start pressing to have people in your area cover this issue so that people can get informed. Because, I tell you, if you've been listening to the media in the U.S., you don't know anything about this. I know we sure didn't. And we don't just watch one thing, or listen, or, on the web. But there's quite a bit to this, and these folks are really being hung out to dry. And that's putting it kindly. So our guest is Dr. Harry Buyens. He's an internationally recognized multiple award-winning PhD in defense and aerospace. He is a physicist. It's like, what? So he comes from a science background, which is really great. This isn't all just a bunch of opinion and emotion. So he's originally from South Africa, and he has a 360-year bloodline in that country. He lives with his family currently on the forested slopes outside of Vancouver, Canada. But his life as a scientist exposed him to many of the realities of the Cold War and the period immediately following the fall of the Berlin Wall. It included interaction with the United States and the British defense establishment. So he has applied his lifetime of research and interpretive skills to history and genealogy. And I know he doesn't like this part, but it really is good, whoever wrote it. He writes with factual accuracy and an engaging style on these subjects. And, we could listen to him tell us stories all day, even though this is tough information to hear. He makes it very palatable. I have information about his book and his blog, which is extremely informational, all on the website. You can find them all at wethepeopleradio.us. So, back to South Africa, and today we're talking about politics, because we kind of veered in and out of that. First show, I should just tell people, I guess, was history. Last week, we talked about what's currently happening and kind of why. But I think it's important to go back and fill in the blanks on the actual politics that are happening in that country and what's driving all of this, I guess. So, that's the end of our part. Take it away.
Well, good morning, Aaron, Bill, and good morning to whoever is listening today. Yes, my name's Harry Buyens. That surname is an old German one from the far north of Germany, where there's still lots of those guys around. And it's an old German surname because my first ancestor of that surname arrived in South Africa in the year 1710, which is two generations later than my first ancestor down there, who arrived in 1657. And he wasn't even my oldest actual local ancestor, because I'm descended from the originals who lived in the Cape area. That's enough about my genealogy. That bit about being a physicist, Aaron, just really quickly. I was born with a terrible affliction, and that's what made me become a physicist. So what you need to understand is that it is the desire for understanding stuff that drives people to become physicists. You don't become a physicist and then start trying to figure out how things work. It is the psychological conundrum of being unable to function unless you understand that makes people into physicists, and I suffer from that. That was, in my case, kind of exacerbated by the reality that my mother pointed out Sputnik to me when I was 2 months earlier than 4 years old. I was just on 4 years. And she pointed out Sputnik, and there and then she told me that the scientists put it up there, so I wanted to become a scientist as well. And that's how I ended up with a string of descriptions that you've just read. I would like to plead being a normal human being, and I would also like to explain that I don't have any gift of clairvoyance or anything like that. I'm just constantly irritated by the fact that why can't people figure these things out? I can really demonstrate that I'm not more intelligent than other people. I've had that tested. I know for a fact that my wife is much more intelligent than I am.
She reminds me of that every day.
No, I'm serious. She's kind of one of these prodigies that kept scoring 96 for all tests at university, and I had to really work hard to get to 75. I've learned to know when to shut up in the household, because as Bill will tell you, if there's 10 guys in a room and one lady walks in, the men are outnumbered. I assure you that the world is entirely flat. I know I'm a physicist, but the world's entirely flat and works the same way everywhere. And this little truth I just shared with you works the same way in South Africa.
Well, it does. And the sooner you accept that fact, the happier you'll be. So,
okay. With that as an intro, I mentioned to Aaron that I probably should just try and very quickly go through some of the points we've made in the previous sessions. One of those is that, and these are things that people generally don't know, and it confuses South Africans, because our jaws hit the ground when people speak to us, and we realize, oops, they don't know. The first thing is that white people have been in South Africa since 1652. That's when they got there, 1652. New York was 1625, so it's within a generation of New York. When they got there, the black people were 700 miles away as the crow flies, 800 along the coast. Next, black South African people were never enslaved by any white man from anywhere. That's an important point, and you'll see why in a little bit later. They were indeed enslaved by Mandela's Amakosa people, or as their chief Hintsa said to the British, "Are the Amafengu not my dogs? Can I not make with them as I please?" Ironically, these Amafengu people were freed from slavery by my ancestors. Hmm. Okay. And then in the weirdest ironic twist of all, it is actually the white folks in South Africa who have the slave ancestors, not the black people, really. And I'm a very good example of that, and I gave that description in an earlier session. The next major point was that there are remarkable parallels in history between South Africa and the United States. But unfortunately, there are sometimes parallels drawn that really are completely wrong and cause tremendous trouble. So let's look at just quickly some of the amazing parallels. Both were started by the Dutch before 1655. By the way, Cape Town and New York both had a street called Herengracht. In your case, that became Broadway, and in our case in Cape Town, it stayed Herengracht.
Well, New York was previously known as New Amsterdam, wasn't
correct.
It? Correct. Yeah.
And just to push that point a little, my wife's one ancestor was the first American immigrant to the Cape in 1666, and she was in fact born in New York in what is today the shadow of the Goldman Sachs building. Now, the next thing, and always these amazing parallels, both were stolen by the English. I should call them English because they weren't the British back then, they were the English. They were both subsequently sold by the Dutch to the English. Both nations fought two wars against the British. Both won their first war. Okay? Amazingly We, a little farming nation stuck in a little place in Africa, won the first war against the British. They were mad as anything about that. The big difference is South Africa lost the second one, and concentration camps were invented for my folks in there. I lost 57% of the Bruyens family members who went into those camps. 57% died there, mostly women and children.
And this was in 1901.
Okay.
We have to take a really quick break, so I don't want to break up any of that. But, let that sink in. Concentration camps in South Africa for the white people in 1901. So I think everybody credits Hitler with the invention of those. But, no. Somebody beat him to it. The English. Going to take a quick break. We're here with our guest, Dr. Harry Bruyens. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I can't do everything, but I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone.
Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies.
I thought I'd throw that song in there as a little shout-out to the media. And what a great job they've done on South Africa.
I must remember that particular tune.
Very fitting.
I was like, why didn't I play that one before? That's a good one for Harry's show.
That was Fleetwood Mac, unless I'm mistaken.
Yep. Was it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I should know. I've been playing in a band for many, many, many years. I first started playing guitar when I heard the Beatles the first time. So I'm in the category that's not allowed to make mistakes on the guitar anymore. I think I'll recognize Fleetwood Mac. That's the other thing about the science guys. They come in two categories, right? Those who want to play sport while they do their science and those who play music. I'm the mathematical type that plays music.
Mm.
Okay. I was going to say that last week we then went on to a category that I can best describe as sex, lies, and map-making. That related to the distribution of people, how those maps got made, what it had to do with demographics, hence my working the way the word sex in there. And the lies are always close to the surface when it comes to South Africa. The point to remember out of that little session, I guess, is that the western half of the country never really saw black people. The western half of the country. So most of this terrible trauma that you're hearing about is in the eastern half of the country. Now, Aaron, what you need to tell me is I now stand before a fork in the road. Of content. I have in my hand this little what if list that I see you put up on the website. I have the matter of the Black Economic Empowerment Act in South Africa, which should be called the White Economic Destruction Act.
Yeah, we've got to do that.
And then there is the sort of brazen political history there. Okay? I'm inclined to go with the central point, which is this Black Economic Empowerment Act thing.
Yes,
well, I'd like to start, if we could, could we go back to when they got rid of apartheid, the Mandela movement, so to speak. Everybody was, you know, oh my gosh, he's been freed. You know, South Africa now is going to be, you know, a new country. That's not really the truth. I mean,
well, that's where this Black Empowerment Act comes in.
Yeah, let's go there and let people know what really happened during that time.
Okay. I think history since 1994, and I'm sort of thinking on the fly here about it, can probably be divided into a number of periods. The first period is Nelson Mandela is in charge. He's making everyday conciliatory comments. There's that big international rugby match that everybody's seen movies about. You know, half of that, of course, is junk, but nevertheless, the principle is still there, the overwhelming emotion of the day when this guy who had tried to kill us walks up and everybody's cheering for the same side. And that's very powerful. There's no doubt about it. So that was the first era. But he didn't really manage or do anything. He had guys under him doing stuff. You know, it's best summarized by a lady at the place where I worked, a manager on the same level as me, sitting in a meeting, and somebody making a statement out front saying, Mandela this, Mandela that, Mandela this, Mandela that. And she pumps me in my side. So this is a black lady manager. She pumps me in my side and she says, what the hell does Mandela know? He sat in jail for 26 years. Now, that's not me saying it. That is my colleague, a black lady, pumping me in the side, whispering that in my ear.
Now, now this is during a time of great transition from white to black control.
Sure. The government is a fully black control at that point already. At the point that I'm talking about, the old National Party had essentially gone defunct. And it's just as this Thabo Mbeki character, the next guy, was taking over. Mbeki was the vice president essentially to, or one of the vice presidents to Mandela. The other guy, the one that Mandela really wanted to follow him up, was Cyril Ramaphosa. Now, Ramaphosa, I'm going to roll that R because in East Nation they do it too. So Cyril Ramaphosa, he is of the Venda Nation in the far, far distant northern little smidgen of South Africa. He was born in Soweto, but his culture, background, and some of his education was in the far north. Ramaphosa was the guy who really negotiated the whole transfer from the old white government to Mandela. So Ramaphosa is a very competent guy. Make no mistake about that. Ramaphosa knows what he's doing. He's a competent politician. He's a competent negotiator. He is no one's idiot. Mm-hmm. But it didn't work, and Thabo Mbeki became the next president. Mbeki was president until about 2007. Now, over that period, this act, this Black Economic Empowerment Act, was imposed. I'm telling you that as a guy who lived in South Africa in the period when Mbeki took over, it was like ice water was poured over the country. And immediately, if you were a white man, you knew that you're in trouble. You knew you were in trouble. It's just the way that Mbeki handled everything. It was vividly obvious that he hated white men.
Were there any whites at this point in any capacity in the government?
Oh, yeah. But those who had any kind of authority were communists.
Okay.
Okay. So, and I personally met some of them. I shook hands with some of them. And if you read my book, you'll find the one guy in there. Okay? And he was one of those that had hidden out in a bomb shelter in Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, while the South African Air Force bombed them. This in retaliation for the biggest car bomb that South Africa ever suffered. So, yeah, he was a foot soldier on the other side, and so he happens to be a white guy. Big deal. I'm not going to be swayed by the fact that his skin is white.
Mm-hmm.
So that second period was Mbeki, and he started implementing, based on Ramaphosa's plans, he started implementing these laws that started to grind down white people, systematically grind them down in every way conceivable. And then in 2007, it turned to open political warfare between the biggest or the highest ranking Zulu guy in that ANC party, and his name was Jacob Zuma. And Zuma won the toss, so to speak. Now, what you need to understand is that ANC party has such a preponderance of votes in, or has always had, such a preponderance of votes in parliament, that your national president is not determined by the general democratic voter. It's determined by the party caucus. Because whoever becomes the leader of the party automatically defaults to being the president of the country. So you've got to get your heads off the idea that South Africans vote for a president like you voted for Donald Trump. It just doesn't happen. That's not the way it works. Okay? So we just get the guy because their party said so. Period. Whoever they decide, that's what you got to live with. So that's the system that they have. So first it was Mandela, and it was called, people refer to it as the honeymoon. Then there was Mbeki, which was like a ton of iced water going down your back. And it's over that period that I and my family packed our bags and left. And then 2007 onwards came Zuma. And Zuma, I'm frankly going to describe him as intelligent, but culturally very much the standard Zulu tribal chief, corrupt as anything. You pay your homage to the chief. You bring him presents, and he gives you presents. He doles out where you can put your hut, etc., etc.
Now, was he communist?
He's a communist, absolutely.
Okay.
But you need to. I'll have to come back to this thing of land ownership, because in Africa, the idea of individual land ownership is not comprehended. Okay, their idea of African socialism is not communism as in the Russian model. So we need to come back to that somehow. But for now, because you asked me to explain the politics, first Mandela, then Mbeki, then came the Zuma character, and it was obvious almost from day one that this is going to be a classic corrupt African village. That's what we had. And today I started receiving links from concerned South Africans here in Canada. They've dug out just how the tax coffers have been raided in South Africa, for example. The man stole the country blind. Okay? And he imported guys from India, a family of brothers, who basically started running the country, and they were deciding on who was going to be appointments to cabinet posts and stuff like that. And they only appointed guys that would, you know, give them kickbacks and all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute, just endless corruption. Millions of dollars just disappeared down a hole. So,
what a great transition. That's just what every country needs. Oh my gosh. We have to take a really quick break and then we'll
pick this up.
We'll delve back into the corruption.
This is what I need to know.
Get back to the false stage.
Yeah, we can't cut out before the corruption. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Harry Bouyans. what we're hoping for. Although we won't be discussing the hero in this segment.
Okay.
All right, Harry. Yep.
Okay, if we can move on. That noise in the background is me quickly printing out some of the paperwork related to that act that we want to get to.
Okay.
I've mentioned that there were four phases in this political history since 94. The first was, call it the honeymoon with Mandela. The second was the ice water down the back with Thabo Mbeki. The third one was true black African village style corruption setting in for the years from until now. And then roughly a year before he was due to stand for another election or be kicked out, Zuma was dethroned by Ramaphosa, Cyril Ramaphosa. Now, just to run through it, the first president was basically of the broader Amakosa nation. This Mandela. Mbeki, similarly, was one of those. The third one was a Zulu. And now the fourth one, he's of the Bavenda. He is of the Venda nation. The Ba prefix is another way of saying nation. So Cyril Ramaphosa, he was Mandela's favorite understudy.
So he was ANC?
Say again?
What was he? Was he part of the ANC?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. Everybody that I've mentioned, all of them are totally that party. And Ramaphosa basically went up against the Zuma faction in the party right at the end of last year and the earlier part of this year. And somewhere around February, he finally got the job. But apparently only after a midnightly deal in which he committed to this idea of land expropriation without compensation. So to get the votes inside the party caucus, he did that. And sure enough, when that matter came before Parliament, the ANC voted for it. And that now requires a change in the constitution, which requires a certain percentage vote. And it is likely that they will get that vote in Parliament if they go for it. But its so-called Article 25 of the Constitution would have to be changed to allow for expropriation without remuneration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like I said last time, you guys have got eminent domain, but I believe it pretty clearly says that there has to be remuneration. And I believe I even heard President Trump defend that on one occasion. And I can understand that. But this is something else. This is legalized theft we're talking about. And this is nationalization by any other word. It means taking people's due titled property. And it doesn't just say land. It says property. Folks need to understand that. So they're wanting to take that land. Now,
and it isn't like they're trying to build a road, like here, you know, typically, I mean, okay, tons of abuses on eminent domain, I'm not defending it, but the idea originally was they were going to build a road and your house was in the way, and so for the betterment of everybody, you had to, you know, move.
Yes.
This is different.
Yeah.
This is basically, you're the wrong color, and so we're coming to take your stuff.
Bluntly put, yes. And in case you think it's an exaggeration, please be advised that one of the senior guys in the Communist Party was asked to put together a committee to look into how this might work. And he came back and he said, well, that vote in Parliament was maybe not too cleverly conceived because it might backfire in that they might end up taking black people's property. By implication, that means the intention was to take white people's property. Let's make no mistake about that. Okay. So, I mean,
yeah, they're not very good at being politicians.
Okay, so that's where folks now are. Now, the reason why the BEE, Black Economic Empowerment legislation, is relevant now is, suppose these farmers have their lands taken. First of all, they got almost zero chance of getting any form of employment because they were white. And the affirmative action process in that country makes it virtually impossible for a white man over 40 to get a job. Now, the next thing they can do is set up a business, right? I mean, we're good. Westerners, we can be entrepreneurial. We can set up business. There's 40-odd million black people who would want to buy stuff, etc., right? That makes cool sense. No problem, right? Okay, let's go for it. Uh-oh, here's a problem. There is Cyril Ramaphosa's Act, the Black Economic Empowerment Act, made, you know, basically fathered by, sponsored by, driven by, thought up by none other than the current state president. And according to that act, if you have a business that makes that has a revenue of more than $1 million. Now, that's not a big number by any American standard, I would submit. And that's revenue, not profit. If you have a revenue greater than that, then you are subject to the Black Economic Empowerment Act. And the first thing it does is it says that you need to... suppose you... don't make the grade according to that act. You can carry on working, but if you do make the grade, which means you score the right brownie points, and I'll explain these brownie points in a moment, only if you score those brownie points will bigger companies buy from you, or will you get state tenders. Now I have to come at this problem from another side, and that's something that Americans in particular struggle with. You struggle with the following concept because you are 330 million people and you cannot conceive of a nation where getting enough cash together in one heap to do stuff is difficult. One of the most fantastic things about the United States is that the cost of capital is low. In my life as a high-tech guy, I went to the U.S. to try and get money to do projects. And it's tremendously difficult because they kept saying, why don't you just go and raise the capital and build the thing first and then come and show it to us? And my response is, well, where would I go for that? The U.S. is the only place that really has this low cost of capital. Everywhere else, you're half dead by the time you've got the cash together. You haven't got enough life left to actually do the thing. So smaller countries rely very heavily on state tenders and state contracts because that's where the capital concentrates. And there are no IBMs and huge big Boeings and things like that in the other countries that can gather enough capital together to sponsor big projects. So it's a big deal. Now, in South Africa, when a company that does not conform to that act tries to get a contract to survive, he's now limited to buying and selling basically to other guys like himself. So you are stuck with the minnows and the small fry.
Right.
Okay, now you can imagine what that means. So what they've done is they've incentivized this thing in the most vicious way you can conceive of. They have made a law that says if your company is over $1 million, then here's how it works. You need to conform in order to get these big contracts that big companies survive on. You have to have 100 BEE brownie points. And those brownie points contain things like, is your company majority black owned? Is it majority black managed? Does it have a majority of black employees? Do you spend enough money on good stuff for black people out there, and always the word black? And in case you have difficulty understanding the word black, they actually explain it at the top of the act, where they say in as just about as many words, black is anybody who's not white.
Or any kind of a mix that they call colored in South Africa, correct?
Well,
do they still get short shrift?
That's become a bit of a gray area. But basically, if you're white, you're done.
Okay.
Okay. And in case there was confusion for the Chinese folks, they actually went to court and told the government, well, you know, these terrible acts you have against the white people, they're really hurting us. And so they were made honorary blacks.
Really?
Yeah. So,
That makes perfect sense.
I played in a band with two Chinese siblings here in Vancouver. I used to play in a band with Chinese folks in South Africa. So I upped my roots, moved to Canada, and played in a band with two Chinese South Africans over here again. And I joked with them and said, I'm glad to hear you guys are now honorary black.
That's a pretty good deal if you can get it.
Yeah, so if you are unclear, the Act actually just explains for you that black means anyone who is not white. So that would cover, I guess, Mongolians and Eskimos. I don't know who, okay? It's just, it's crazy. It's so brazen. These things that are done are so brazenly anti-white, specifically anti-white. Okay? Now, I don't know how far you are from a commercial break.
We're kind of right there.
I want to read you just a little bit. This comes from The Economist, July the 8th, 2017. Okay? I want to read you just one little paragraph. Mining firms are also being hurt by government policies. A new mining charter, this is the Black Economic Empowerment Charter, introduced last month by South Africa's minister, Mosambenzi Zwane, would force companies to ensure... to ensure that at least 30% of their shares are in black hands, up from 26 previously. Under the new charter, companies would be required to maintain this level of black ownership regardless of whether black investors sell out. Think about that bit. Think about that. Think about what that means. They get 20% of their investors to be black. And then some of them say, oh, cool, I've just been given money. Let me, an investor in South Africa, if it's a black investor, it usually means the white guy just gave up and gave him the shares for free, okay? Or fiddled it around the side so that he seems to have the money. They would also have to pay out at least 1% of their turnover, what you guys would call revenue, each year to their black shareholders. So, had this rule been in effect in 2016, black shareholders would have got 5.8 billion South African rands of the total of 5.9 billion rand paid as dividends, leaving pretty much nothing for anyone else, notes the Chamber of Mines of South Africa. How would you like to have an investment where you get a dividend no matter what the hell happens?
Yeah.
Wow.
And all you have to do is be black. That's all you have to do.
So how are they, well, when we come back, I'm curious, how are they able to bring any investors in if these rules are in effect? So we'll talk about that when we come back.
And therein lies the problem and the ultimate destruction going forward. Things like this only work for a little while. It's like a weird Ponzi scheme, you know. They eventually, well, what is it? They run out of other people's money.
Yeah.
Maggie Thatcher was perfectly right. And this is why Cyril Ramaphosa is here in Canada this weekend.
Oh.
Looking for money.
Lovely.
All right.
All right. Quick break. We're going to be back with our guest, Dr. Harry Bouyans. You can find all the information about him and previous shows with him in the last couple of weeks, so you don't feel like you came in halfway through the movie, at wethepeopleradio.us.
What I felt was right. Like a rock, like a rock. I was strong as I could be, like a rock. Nothing ever got to me, like a rock. I was something to see, like a rock.
You have to learn to pace yourself. Pressure. You're just like everybody else. Pressure. You've only had to run so far, so good. But you will come to a place where the only thing you feel are loaded guns in your face. You'll have to deal with pressure.
Pressure.
Yeah, that pretty much sizes it up.
That's the new theme song of the Black Economic Empowerment Act.
So, you know, I was thinking, I have here in front of me an article that was written in the last several days by a guy named Gerard Papenfuss. He's the chief executive of the National Employers Association, not employee, but employer association of South Africa. So he's written an open letter to the Labour Minister. And he says, if you'll allow me to read, because I cannot state it any better than this guy does. Dear Minister, since I am, quote, white, comma, I take note that when you talk so boldly about us, quote, whites, being the stumbling block in terms of your transformation agenda, I write this letter to you in order to get clarity. According to your party's National Democratic Revolution, they love this word revolution because they're communists, the eventual target of your, quote, transformation, unquote, policies is that every facet of the South African society, that is, people in employment, ownership of business, participation in sports teams, shares on the Joburg Stock Exchange, education, the list goes on and on, comma, must reflect the demographical composition of South African society, approximately 80% black, 10% white, 8% colored, and 2% Indian. Hard work and skills are no longer the criteria, just the color of your skin. Quality is sacrificed in an obsessive pursuit of quotas on the basis of skin color. Total madness, exclamation mark. However, you, Minister, and your colleagues are pursuing these ideals bit by bit in every area and in every piece of legislation. Minister, since the NDR envisages a seamless transition, you have to pursue this destructive path, and the current status and intensity of all transformational legislation is therefore merely an interim arrangement in your attempt to achieve your ideological version of a transformed society. The term seamless transition implies you'll never achieve it. Even Hitler could not. But you will not stop trying, turning on the screws as you're flailing while systematically breaking down the economy. And then he says, you are obviously frustrated by the lack of progress measured against your ideas and the ideals of your revolution. Therefore, Minister, you need to give us employers some clarity as to how you want us to implement your plan, seeing as you have given us 6 months to rectify the so-called, quote, situation, failing which, according to you, we will, quote, face the full might of the law. Since the, quote, whites, unquote, in our employ has such a, quote, tight grip, unquote, on their jobs, according to you, please advise, Minister, how we can get rid of them, should any employer wish to do so. Their rights are entrenched in the Constitutional Republic and Labor Relations Act. This is the kind of thing, by the way, this is Harry now. Everybody gets all pink and happy about the South African Constitution, all this stuff, and people like saying it's a wonderful constitution, but they don't deal with the realities. This act is the actual reality. Since you are, Mr. Minister, a custodian of this act, you must be aware of the fact that huge penalties await employers if they dismiss employees without good reason, and the penalty is even more severe if the dismissal is done for reasons based on color of anyone's skin. So, even if we want to get rid of these, quote, whites, unquote, it is not possible within the current legal framework. These pieces of legislation which protects minorities against unfair dismissal must be a source of huge frustration to you, Minister, especially against the backdrops of your desire to rid the workplace of these, quote, whites, unquote, who so, quote, stubbornly, unquote, cling to their jobs. Are you getting the general drift of this?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, because here they're clinging to what, Bibles and guns, and there they're trying to cling to their jobs. We're just in different phases
in
of this
lives.
Program.
And here comes the bit where he spells it out. Should the employers decide to rid the workplaces of these stubborn whites, unquote, even unlawfully, they are faced with a moral dilemma, Minister. Where will they go? If your transformation plan is to be implemented to the letter, there would be no place for them to go. The state, the parastatal organizations, the municipalities, even the corporate private sector are no-go areas for them as long as the seamless transition of yours applies. And if you could have your wish, since the demographic targets will never be met, they will have nowhere to go forever.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the sad part is they will be forever dependent on foreign aid
As a country.
As a country.
But you know what? If you go to Wikipedia, because, you know, it's always a great resource. Kidding. It was interesting because here's a little quote from the Black Economic Empowerment Commission. There's just the first sentence is a killer. It's an integrated and coherent socioeconomic process. It's located within it. Within the context of the country's national transformation program.
Yeah.
Guys, if you've ever read anything written by the old-style communists, you'll notice this one thing they suffer from. They have a terrible inferiority complex, and they try to conjure up fancy words and statements and five-year plans, anything that they think will sound clever to the so-called, unquote, masses that they and their cadres that they lead, you know. So it's important to these people to always sound like they have a fancy theory. It's like, you know, I've dealt with many scientists in my life, and as soon as they speak fancy, I know they don't know their subject.
Yeah,
kind of funny how that works.
Fancy.
That's true in a lot of different things.
Yeah. You know, they can cut the fancy speak and get to the facts. This guy, Papenfuss, is getting to the facts. The communists like fancy speak and don't like being called on the numbers.
I can imagine.
That's why I said liberals and communists cannot do maths. You cannot make 90% of the country rich by forever stealing from 10% of the population. You cannot make 40 million black people rich by stealing farms from 35,000 farmers. All you're going to get is ineffectual little blotches of land, none of which will be effective, none of which will be economic. It is death.
Yeah, and none of them will grow food. Kind of short-sighted in so many ways, it's hard to even point out. So, of course, we only have 2 minutes left because we never have enough time on this. You had made a comment in a phone call that we had about tearing down the... I mean, this seems like a real swerve here, but I just wanted to make sure we included it. The tearing down of the Confederate statues.
Yeah. Born in South Africa. I cannot remember now exactly which date it was, but during early last year or late the year before, there was a whole effort that started at Cape Town University around the matter of the statue of Cecil John Rhodes. Now, I hate that guy because he caused the deaths of many of my family and made a war on us. But I don't want his statue torn down. That seems just stupid. Anyway... So these black students gathered and they threw feces all over the statue, demanded it be torn down, and eventually the lame rear-ended Cape Town University chiefs tore the statue down, moved it away, and so be it. Next thing, a black South African student ended up at Oxford University, and at Oxford University the next moment they heard the same thing, and suddenly statues had to be torn down at Oxford. And then students at Berkeley acknowledged the Oxford effort and started talking about it, and the next moment it was Robert E. Lee's turn.
Isn't that stunning? I just wanted to make sure we didn't miss that link, since that's a huge factor. All right, Harry, we're out of time, but we're doing this some more because we can't get enough South Africa. What's actually going on? Obviously, we're not being told any of this. Thank you so much for wising us up. And to all our new friends in South Africa, hang in there, you guys. We're paying attention. See you guys next week. You can find all the information at wethepeopleradio.us.